This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, disastrous news about melting ice in Antarctica. Will it finally convince the climate change skeptics? Also, the New York Times shocks journalism by firing Jill Abramson as its editor. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Julia Turner. On this week's Culture GabFest, the history of the cubicle, that delineator of our lives at work, and the film Locke, an unexpectedly gripping, existential, real-time car ride. And finally, is the cartoon hit Adventure Time meant for kids, stoners, or philosophers? Maybe all three.
Maybe dating girls is like riding a bicycle.
Yeah, man, yeah!
We're like, if you mess up, you could get really hurt forever, or hurt someone you really care about.
Well, I suppose.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The West Antarctic ice sheet is melting and nothing can stop it. Global sea levels will rise 4 feet in coming centuries and much worse could follow. Will this finally sway Washington to act on climate change? Then Jill Abramson was the first woman to edit the New York Times and is a journalist of brilliance and moxie. She was fired abruptly this week for mysterious reasons. Was she the victim of sexism? I'm joined in Washington today by John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And in New Haven by Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
Scientists announced this week that the West Antarctic ice sheet is inevitably melting, a process that will, over the next couple of centuries, take billions and billions and billions of gallons of land-bound ice and dump it into the ocean, causing a sea level rise and incomprehensible changes to climate. The culprit for the melting is, of course, climate change, and the scientists involved say there is, at this point, really nothing we can do to stop this melting, and perhaps little we can do to stop the temperature changes that are causing it to happen. We are joined today by Phil Plait, who's the author of Slate's Bad Astronomy blog, one of the most vivid writers on climate change. Phil is going to give us a primer on how to think about this, and we'll talk about why certain Americans still are so skeptical of it. So, Phil, tell us a little bit more about what this announcement is, why it's significant.
Sure. What's going on is that Antarctica is a continent. It is a large landmass that is covered with ice, and in some places this ice is several miles thick. Now, we've known that on the West Antarctica area, the ice there is melting. It's been melting quite a bit over the past few decades. In fact, up until now, we've even known that it is melting at a rate of roughly, now get this, 100 billion tons per year. That is billion with a B and tons with a T. So that's a huge amount of ice that's melting, and Antarctica is very large. It's got a lot to dump out there. What is new is that a couple of studies have actually been able to model how quickly they are melting, and another study has shown that there's really nothing that's going to stop it. For example, when these glaciers, they're ice, they're sitting on land, and they flow over time into the water. And as they flow into the water, they float, ice floats. And it forms a tongue of sorts that floats on the water. Well, a while ago, there was an underground or an underwater ridge that was supporting one of these tongues of ice. And when that finally let go, it started melting even faster. But the point there is that that ridge sort of slowed the melting of that tongue of ice. Well, what the scientists have found is that there's nothing under this ice that can now stop it from melting. When they map out the topography of the land underneath that ice, there are no ridges, there's no hills, there's no dams of dirt that is going to stop this thing. And now with the world warming up, basically this glacier, this huge West Antarctic area, is going to melt catastrophically, basically. It's going to take 200 years, which is a long time, but the inevitability of it is the part that's actually a little bit terrifying.
So when we talk about ice that's in the northern hemisphere, the North Pole, melting, there's less worry about it as an effect on oceans rising because it won't cause the oceans to rise because that ice is already floating. But this will cause the ocean to rise, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion about that. The ice that's at the North Pole in the Arctic is not on land. There's no continent underneath that ice. It's just sea ice that floats. More or less, if it were to melt, the sea level wouldn't change. In fact, it would a little bit because the physics of it is a little bit complicated when you have freshwater ice and salt water and that sort of thing. But it's not a catastrophic amount. The thing to worry about are the glaciers and the ice that's on land, and that's mostly, the vast majority of it, is in Antarctica in the south and Greenland in the north. And so that's the worry here. If this West Antarctic glacier sheet melts, it could cause global sea level rises of over a meter, roughly 4 feet, and that is enough to inundate coastal cities. You know, we've seen a few inches to a foot of global sea level rise in the past century, and that has actually changed how storms flood cities. We saw what happened with Superstorm Sandy a couple of years ago. That brought in a surge of seawater, and because of sea level rise and the strength of that particular storm, it flooded lower Manhattan. And it's not hard to see these things doing hundreds of millions or either billions of dollars of damage simply because the storms are getting stronger and they're bringing in more water.
Phil, year 200 feels like, for a lot of people, it's going to feel like, oh, well, that's such a long way away.
Those are my great-great-great-grandchildren, not my great-grandchildren. Who cares?
Yeah, right. Screw them, right? Screw humanity. Who needs them?
So I guess the question is, will this be a steady line? Will it be an exponential feeling of the effects? Will we start to feel effects more noticeably in 20, 30 years that are connected with this 200-year proposition? Give us a sense of the timeline of how this plays out. Or will it just be like a steady increase that will actually be linear over 200 years?
Well, that's hard to say. Basically, you're seeing a certain amount of meltwater coming off of these glaciers now. If you try to project that into the future, what will happen is at some point it will become stronger and stronger, and it basically reaches, and I hate to use this phrase, but it's apt, it reaches a tipping point where suddenly, over the course of maybe years or decades, a couple of decades, you lose a catastrophic amount of ice from the glacier. So right now it's essentially steady. A big question is, will it increase? Don't know. Will it take 200 years or 500 years? Don't know. The scientists said that this catastrophe, what they call a collapse, and I'll get back to that in a sec, that could happen 200 years from now or 900 years from now. They're not sure. They can only give a range. But statistically speaking, it's more likely to happen sooner rather than later. And yeah, 200 years seems like a long time, but this is inevitable, right? 200 years ago, we started building our cities on rivers and on the coastline and all that kind of thing. If we had known that the ocean levels would rise 4 feet and swamp these cities, would we have built them there? Well, yeah, probably. People are ridiculous. We keep building cities on the foothills of volcanoes that keep blowing up, so it's hard for us to learn. But this is a serious problem. It's not so much an immediate threat as it is, to me, another voice rising about climate change and how devastating this is to the planet.
So the other week before we got this dismal news, there was a huge map of the United States showing the warming that's already happening. That felt very immediate to me. And I looked at that and the rising temperatures and thought, I mean, we're all experiencing this in some ways in different parts of the country, the sense of extreme weather. And there was a special emphasis on torrential rains and the way that is going to put other parts of our infrastructure and coastal cities in jeopardy. How long can Republican politicians like Marco Rubio really ignore all of this when there are all these cities and state governments and businesses that are already adjusting to it? It's like we're doing the adjusting even though we haven't reckoned with the causes and the reality.
Yeah, it's a bizarre lapse of the concept of reality, which is becoming a party plank in the GOP, it seems. I don't know when they'll ever admit it. It may be when they're going back to their home states and drowning. You know, Florida, for example, is a really, really, really vulnerable to climate change and sea level rise because so much of it is lowlands and on the coast. And they have aquifers they depend on, which can be flooded with seawater. This is a very, very serious problem. James Inhofe, a senator from Oklahoma, who has called climate change the man-made climate change, the largest hoax ever perpetrated, he just basically dissed a bunch of flippin' military ex-generals who came out with a study that said, yeah, climate change is a big security threat and we need to take this seriously. And he basically called them crackpots. and said he wished he was back in the Cold War days when people were more canny about reality. And it's like, really? Really? And it's mind-boggling. We are in the middle of the effects of global warming right now. It's kind of like having a systemic illness. You have the flu, and your stomach's upset. You might be throwing up. You might be weak, and you don't know which one of these things might be directly due to the flu or something you ate or whatever. But you know what? The flu is affecting your entire body. It's affecting everything. That's what global warming is doing. It's what climate change is doing. It's affecting everything on our planet, and it's hard to know exactly, did this storm happen? Was that torrential rain because of climate change? We don't know, but we're getting more of these things. We're getting, and not just more. If it were a direct, we're getting more forest fires because of climate change, that would make it a lot more obvious. But in fact, the effects are more subtle. It's not that we're getting more rain. It's that we're getting longer periods of drought and then heavier rains afterwards. Things like that, they're sort of second-order effects. They're more subtle.
So, Phil, here's a question for you. Given how little success people like you, who are speaking out forcefully about climate change, are having in convincing a most significant constituency of the American public and American political system to change their minds about this, what is the strategy that you should pursue that will succeed in changing their mind insofar as information doesn't seem to be it? Is there a way that ridicule or humor or, dancing girls could change the way the American right thinks about this issue? Or is it a completely lost cause?
Well, I wish there were a silver bullet. I haven't found one. If I had, I'd be using it. And I would be using it on a number of issues, not just climate change. You're never going to convince somebody like Inhofe or Rubio or any of these folks that they're wrong. And let me throw in that John Huntsman is a moderate Republican who completely acknowledges everything that is correct about climate change, that we're causing it and that it's a catastrophe and we need to be talking about it. And he's chewing over the idea of a run for president again, but I think he got like 1% of the vote in the Republican primary a couple of years ago, so it doesn't seem like he has much of a chance. Facts don't speak for themselves. This is something that scientists always like to say. Well, the facts speak for themselves. Like, well, no, that's completely not true. If that were true, we wouldn't be having any discussion about creationism in this country or climate change or vaccine denial or anything like that. I wish I did know what it was. The Republican consolidation with the religious right back in the 80s is really what started this whole thing. And then, of course, the oil industry coming in with these southern states in Oklahoma and Texas, Joe Barton from Texas, who has received a huge amount of money from the oil industry, and he's the one who apologized to the guy from BP for having our Gulf of Mexico get in the way of all their oil a couple of years back. One thing that's interesting, Catherine Cahill is an evangelical Christian climate scientist, and she's been talking to religious groups about this. And that, to me, might be an interesting inroad. If you can separate out the religious right from the right, from the GOP, then there might be a way of wedging into this a little glimpse of reality. It seems to happen sometimes in creationism when you talk about religious folks who aren't necessarily creationists. You can actually get in there and do that. I'm hoping that she's very vocal and she might be able to get out there and do this as well.
The challenge, though, of course, with this is not just a kind of convincing somebody at a dinner table argument. You then have to get them to buy on and sign on to legislation. And that's the problem, particularly when we look at, say, evangelicals who've tried to push Republicans to take and embrace some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. They've gotten nowhere.
Phil Plait is the author of Slate's Bad Astronomy blog. Phil, thank you for joining us on the GabFest. Come back, talk about vaccines or climate change. We should talk about this more. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David.
Coming up, is the New York Times sexist for firing editor Jill Abramson? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. On Wednesday, Jill Abramson was fired suddenly and mysteriously as the executive editor of the New York Times. Abramson, who was the first woman to edit the Times, had run the paper for only about 2 years. She is being replaced by her number two, Dean Baquet, who is now the first African-American to run the Times editorially. The paper is growing. It's profitable. It's seen as widely successful on the internet. It's seen as widely successful with its new digital subscriptions. It has won a lot of Pulitzers under Abramson. The journalism seemed excellent, so her departure is strange. There are rumors, there are insinuations, hints, allegations. Some reporting says that Abramson's dissatisfaction with her pay was the source of the firing. Others say it was her conflict with the Times' new business boss, Mark Thompson. Others say it was the result of Abramson's plan to bring in a second deputy editor without seeking Baquet's approval. Others see basic sexism on the part of Thompson and Times owner Arthur Sulzberger. So we're a little bit in the dark. We don't have all the facts here, but there's been a lot of really interesting writing about Abramson, the Times, her firing. So let's talk about it. Emily, what is the most persuasive theory you've heard about this so far?
I think the most persuasive theory is some combination of the management issues that was going on. And to speculate for a minute, you know, if Abramson was trying to hire another editor at Baquet's level and Baquet didn't want that to happen, you can imagine that Arthur Sulzberger felt like he was choosing between the two of them. And, you know, I do think there were some real unrest at the Times and mixed feelings about Jill Abramson's tenure. On the other hand, I have to say, this whole thing makes me so heartsick. I mean, it is bad for women writ large. And also, Jill Abramson is an amazing, hard-charging female journalist and someone who's been very good to me personally. And so the idea that someone with all of her skills and talent didn't succeed or was perceived at not succeeding in this role, for me, it's pretty heartbreaking. Not that it can't be true, but it can be true and really sad at the same time.
Do you think, Emily, and I guess John too, that it is in fact true that there are forms of behavior that women in leadership cannot exhibit that men can? Forms of brusqueness and rudeness and bullying people over, which apparently Abramson does some, as many people do, that are just unacceptable because the person doing it is a woman.
Yeah, I do pretty much think that. I mean, you stated it very baldly. I guess I would shade it a little more to say that it is much harder to pull off a certain kind of brusque, abrasive management style. You know, there's been a lot of bridling about some of the words used to describe Jill, bitchy and pushy and confrontational. We were arguing a few weeks ago about the word emotional being used to describe Dianne Feinstein. And I'm sympathetic to the idea that these words are kind of gender little warning bells that go off. On the other hand, there has to be some way to talk about problems that women have with their management styles that are gender inflected, but are still troublesome for the people who are trying to work with them or work for them. And I mean, Jill had hired someone as like a management consultant. So obviously there was some self-awareness that there were things that she needed to work on here.
This has always been one of the curiosities for me about journalism. And that is that in a lot of organizations, people who are elevated to management positions are usually the people who were great journalists. And the two tasks don't necessarily have anything to do with each other. In fact, some investigative reporters, of which Jill Abramson was an investigative reporter, they operate totally alone. So management, this is not a news story. There are at least in time, at a time where I worked, which is more closer to the New York Times than here, there were lots and lots of stories about people who were just like this. They were the male version, and this goes back to your point, Emily, is what how do you have a conversation about the kinds of behaviors that were bad in male bosses that a female is exhibiting in exactly the same way, but you don't want to talk about them in a way that seems like you're just loading up a lot of stereotypes on them. There's got to be a way to talk about an executive editor who's a woman who happens also to be, you know, a bad manager and exhibiting all those kind of bullying skills. I'm not saying in this particular case, I'm just saying in general.
Right. I mean, Sulzberger, one of the things Sulzberger said is, oh, when we get women in leadership, women are going to get fired. And that's a true enough statement. It just is a little bit suspect when the two prominent people you've hired are the two women you have at the highest rank, Janet Robinson, who was the predecessor of Mark Thompson as the, I guess, the COO of the Times, and now Jill Abramson, and that they're cashiered really quickly. So the theory is good, but the practice is alarming.
Well, and also if you have a really small number of women or any particular group in power, then each one stands for a much greater share of the whole. And that's why I think there's such a sense of deflation today among female journalists. It's partly personal about Jill, because I think a lot of people are genuinely super impressed by her and fond of her. But I think there's also just this sense of the first, you know, New York Times female editor is perceived as a failure. And this was such a kind of humiliating firing. Then what does that mean for the next person's chances?
I strongly doubt, even when all the facts of this come out, that people are going to think, oh, Arthur Sulzberger, what a wise man. I think people are going to think, gosh, he has taken this woman of extraordinary talent and ambition and for pretty trivial reasons got rid of her, and reasons that are not going to reflect well on him in the future. As good an editor as Becquet may turn out to be, Becquet may turn out to be great. Everyone seems to like him. He seems to be a lovely man. But can I ask one final question, particularly of you, Emily? So if we posit that certain forms of brusqueness and aggression are very hard for women to carry off as managers and that they are penalized for them. If we say that there's something to that, are there any examples of the converse? Are there any things that men get penalized for that women don't as managers? Are there things that men can't do that women can as managers?
I wonder if it's sometimes easier for women to play the kind of hand on your shoulder sympathy card, because that is like a more natural maternal or sisterly role for them to be on. I mean, men can't be touchy in the same way. I think that's true. Like the pressure to leave your office door open when you're talking to an employee or particularly someone younger than you of the opposite sex is higher for men.
Do I have to do that? Oh, my gosh.
I don't know. I wasn't thinking of you in particular.
I don't think so. I think if you made a regular habit of not doing it, it might raise some concerns. What would she do next? Where do you imagine Jill Abramson going next?
I don't know. I mean, I guess, does she want to run another institution? Part of what's so sad about this is her tremendous loyalty to the New York Times. I mean, the detail that was making me really upset yesterday was the idea that she has a tattoo of the T in the Times script. That's just rough. But maybe it also means that you're in a poor bargaining position in some sense, too. I don't know.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture GabFest starts right now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Julia Turner. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, we'll talk about Locke, the ingenious new road movie starring Tom Hardy, and then Adventure Time, the cartoon hit beloved by tween boys, stoners, and philosophers alike. Also, a new history of The Office. Are we disgruntled because of our work or our workplaces? Stephen Metcalf is off for the next few weeks. Joining me today is, of course, Slate's film critic Dana Stevens. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Julia.
And sitting in Steve's chair is David Haglund, Slate senior editor. Hi, David.
Hi, Julia.
Let's start by talking about Locke. Locke is a new movie from the writer and director Stephen Knight. It stars Tom Hardy, whose face is delectably described in every single review of this movie. I think we need to talk about the Tom Hardy face prose boom that we're living through right now. And it's what Manola Dargis in the New York Times called a man in a can movie, which means it's just Tom Hardy in a car for 90 minutes. Dana, tell us a little bit about what happens in this movie, why he's in the car, what he does there, and how this manages to be an interesting movie.
Right. When you hear about this man in a can premise, it sounds like Locke is going to be very claustrophobic and stagey, and I really didn't find it that way at all. I'm interested to hear if you guys did or not, but it really is just Tom Hardy driving a car for 85 minutes, I think the movie lasts. It takes place in real time, so he announces at the beginning of the movie on one of the many phone calls that he makes from his hands-free car phone that he's going to be somewhere in 90 minutes. He's driving from Birmingham to London, and we'll talk about why he's doing that, and he's trying to make good time on the way. And as he's doing so, we witness through all these phone calls that are coming into the car, Ivan Locke's life falling apart, both on a personal and a professional level at the same time. So it's the tension in this movie all comes from the outside. Basically, you see him in the car and, you know, he has to field all these calls that are coming in, both about the construction site that he works at, where he is, I believe, the chief engineer. At any rate, he's in charge of the concrete pour that will form the foundation for this high-rise building. And also calls from his family and, as we soon learn early in the movie, calls from his mistress, who is in London about to have a baby. Actually, to call this woman his mistress is not quite right.
Right. It was a one-night stand, essentially. She was someone he knew from work, and he as he says at one point, basically took pity on her. She was very lonely and felt like there was nothing for her in life. All of which sets up the idea that even when he cheats on his wife, he's a noble, noble man. And I don't know what you guys thought of that, but the character is presented as, I think someone once calls him the best man in England at some point. You know, and that seems crucial to the way the drama is set up, that you believe in him the whole time and you want to see him kind of pull all of this together, somehow master this impossible situation.
Right, noble but flawed also. I mean, he's definitely a fragile sort of protagonist. And when I heard about this movie, as when I heard about the Robert Redford movie All Is Lost, which is man in a can on a boat, I both times thought I would not like the movie because I thought it would be sort of, you and I were discussing this just the other day, sort of an Ernest Hemingway, you know, a macho showpiece. And neither of those movies feel that way at all to me. They're actually both really about the vulnerability of a male character who's trying to match wits with nature in one case and with, I don't know, time, I guess, in the other case. Locke is sort of racing against time.
Well, time and his own essence. I mean, you said, David, that you felt that we're supposed to see him as, you know, the best man in England or an inherently noble man. To me, I think what we're watching is his sense of himself as a noble man who does the right thing. His whole sense of who he is, who Ivan Locke is a man who does the right thing. You know, he's worked 9 years in this construction job and he's never put a foot wrong and he's built up the trust and fealty of everyone around him, and that makes him feel good and is central to his conception of who he is. So to be the sort of guy who bails on the, you know, one of the biggest concrete pours in the history of Europe, has to tell his wife by phone, you know, that he's had this one night stand, all because he's got this idea in his mind that he's the sort of person who is a stand-up guy and thus needs to be at the bedside of this one-night stand as she gives birth, that to me is where the real drama lies. I'm not sure he actually is such a great guy, but I think he thinks he is, and he set himself up in opposition, we learn as the movie goes on, to his father, who was sort of an alcoholic who disappeared, it seems. Before we go any further, you guys, let's listen to a clip from the film.
Hello?
Eddie, it's your dad. Is your mother there?
No, she's not back from the shops yet. She's getting that German beer that you like for the match.
Okay, listen, I won't be back for that.
What?
Something's come up. I can't get out of it.
I'm wearing the shirt. Mum's getting sausages. Oh, yeah, and guess what? She's wearing the shirt as well. Oh, Dad, it's so embarrassing. Yeah, what did you say about coming home?
I won't be back for the match. I'll have to listen to it on the radio.
Dad, you said you'd be back. It's rubbish on the radio. Mum's doing sausages and all.
Is your brother there?
Yeah, do you want a word?
No. Can you just tell your mother to call me when she gets back? Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
I love you.
What?
It's okay. You know what? Just get her to call me when she gets back.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure, all right.
Bye.
Bye, Dad.
Well, one thing you can hear there is the wonderful voice that Tom Hardy developed for this movie. It's a Welsh voice that he said is in part based on Richard Burton and in part based on some sort of management consultant whose voice he loved. And apparently he studied for a week, although the guy's not actually Welsh. And I don't know enough about Wales to know whether it's an authentic accent, but it's a wonderful voice. It's this great combination of soothing, buttery, syrupy richness, you know, but also this kind of steely core within. He seems like somebody who could be very calming and also very frightening to work for, somebody who, you know, is a hard driver. Man.
Can we talk a little bit about his face, too, given that the focus is so heavily there? Yes, and every single review talks about his particularly red, pouty mouth. I mean, he's getting the full ScarJo treatment, right? Like
I talk about his face? Did I go into face
maybe
rants?
Maybe you might have avoided face pros, but
I feel like people have talked about Tom Hardy's mouth all the time, though. I feel like from the moment he came onto the Hollywood scene, people have talked about his rosy lips.
There's also a sense that people don't know exactly what to do with him in Hollywood, right? I mean, this is a fairly small movie. He looks like a movie star. He's a great-looking guy. He is bulked up for, you know, for instance, the Batman movie. And he's also a terrific actor. But somehow he's not – I don't feel like he's really – maybe apart from his mouth, I don't know that he's really lodged in the American consciousness, right? He hasn't had a signature role that I can think of.
No, he's sort of on the edges and the sides a bit. But I like that about him. I mean, I read that they shot this movie in 8 nights. And I'm glad Tom Hardy used 8 nights to make this movie. It's 8 nights of work. It's a great piece of work. My one question about it is sort of how big or lingering a movie it is. I really enjoyed it while watching it. But then when it ended, I felt done with it. Like, it didn't feel like it quite transcended the conceit of the movie. It didn't quite go beyond it to say anything larger than, hey, we can pull off a cool movie that's based on this conceit with this great actor, even despite the fact that it purports to be about existential issues of what makes you a good man versus a bad man, despite the fact that it's called Locke and name checks, you know, a founding political philosopher of the Western tradition, you know, and I think maybe is trying to say something about labor and the ownership of yourself, because he seems to be very concerned with his work. But again, nothing so specific or interesting that I feel like I'm going to be thinking about it for the rest of my days.
But that still made me wish there were more movies like this. I mean, The Shooting Over Eight Nights is even a more complicated story than that, because the way Stephen Knight decided to shoot this is really unusual. He shot it all in sequence, I think 16 times in a row. So they would go driving. It was really filmed in a car that was being towed, I think, so that Tom Hardy wouldn't have to actually drive and possibly get into an accident. And they went all the way through the script twice a night. So at the end, he had 16 complete versions of this kind of filmed play, and he was able to take the best bits from each and cut them together. And that just seems like such a fun, off-the-cuff, experimental, and inexpensive way of making a movie that it made me wish more directors would take those kind of chances.
All right. Well, the film is Locke. It stars Tom Hardy. It's by the director and writer Stephen Knight. Would you guys recommend that people go see it?
I would. I feel like it's the first movie that I got Tom Hardy, that I see the point of Tom Hardy and want to go see him in more things.
Yeah, and even though I think it's flawed, it's enjoyable, it's interesting, and it will lead to conversations like this one, I think.
Coming up, is Adventure Time a cartoon for philosophers? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Julia Turner, along with Dana Stevens and David Haglund, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for things we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, leave a comment while you're there. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next topic. Adventure Time is a show that airs on the Cartoon Network. Its sixth season just commenced, and it has come in, sixth season-wise, for public adulation in many fronts, including perhaps most notably The New Yorker, where the great critic Emily Nussbaum recently wrote a loving ode to the philosophical complexity and animated beauty of this show, which stars a boy and his dog in the land of Ooh and the various adventures they go on, the villains they confront, and the life challenges they must face and overcome. So we figured it was time to dip into the wide and copious world of Adventure Time, and we all watched a number of episodes in preparation for the show. I should say they're all 11-minute episodes, which makes it nice and easy to dip into the world. And I'm curious, do you guys think that this show is basically just a kid's show about a boy and his dog, or does it merit all of the grown-up critical love it's recently been receiving?
Well, it's definitely more than just a kid's show. For one, right away, I don't know what you guys thought, but right away you felt like, you know, there's language that is aiming higher than your ordinary Saturday morning cartoon. The animation, you know, gets quite elaborate at times. And even the emotional issues that it's wrestling with are often more adult than you would expect. For one thing, it's about childhood, but really I think, about puberty and adolescence. So that when it starts, the main character, Finn the human, is 12 years old, and he has, you know, sort of burgeoning crushes, and he's wrestling with those feelings. And I thought that the whole show, I mostly watched the first season, and I gather it changes a great deal after that. And he actually ages, which is unusual for a cartoon. But to me, it felt like a meditation of sorts on that very specific time. And particularly a boy's life, I think, but in a child's life, when you're on the cusp of these changes. I mean, there's an episode where he goes to Lumpy Spaceland or something. I'm not sure I got that exactly right, but where the people are Lumpy, and there's a Lumpy Space Princess who's really funny, I think, and she has this Valley Girl voice, and she loves boys, and she's going to a dance, and he starts to get Lumpy, and, you know, this has to be a metaphor for puberty, right? I mean, it seemed very clear to me. So I thought the whole show was really kind of engaging with that moment in a person's life.
Well, it also incorporates fairy tale in a very powerful way in every episode. Essentially, every little 10-minute episode is a retelling of some kind of fairy tale, or grabbing, snatching bits from different fairy tales. The creator, Pendleton Ward, was a big D&D fan and loved that world of role-playing. And while it's not fantasy, it is something close to fairy tale a lot of the time, but in a skewed way, right? I mean, the princess that you think is going to save you turns out to be an evil monster, and the evil monster turns out to be sort of a pathetic guy who needs help, and the moral valences of the characters are constantly shifting, and I liked that about it.
Yeah, I mean, the artist whose work reminds me most of is Miyazaki, And I love Miyazaki movies, and you go and you're in a beautiful abstract trance of mysteriously shaped beings that often float or surf and do unexpected things and create strange alliances, but remain a little bit mysterious and remote. And in this show, you have very similar characters and creatures and at least modes of movement, if not exactly a style of animation. The animation's a little bit more peppy and defined and less dreamlike and ethereal. But then all the characters kind of are like sarcastic wisecrackers who speak in an American / pseudo-intellectual vernacular that's fun to engage with. And it's basically like Miyazaki, but American and more fun would be how I would put it.
Well, that's where I think, I mean, there aren't a lot of silences, that's true. But I do think that's where the mythology of the show possibly comes in. And this is where, as someone who's sort of just wading into these waters, I feel somewhat intimidated. But I gather that eventually you learn that this is a post-apocalyptic world, that there was something called the War of the Mushrooms or something like that. And that's why the world is sort of magical and mutated, because there was this nuclear holocaust of some sort. And you learn that the Ice King, who in the early episodes is basically just, you know, kind of your standard villain. He's funny, but he's evil, cackling, and not a great deal more than that. It turns out he has this backstory where he was this decent person who was changed forever by the war. So there's a lot going on eventually that maybe there is a kind of subtext or a background that kind of filters through some of the later episodes. It's less clear in the early ones.
Why don't we listen to a clip of the show so we can get some of its texture?
Hey, Finn, you okay?
No way, dude. Those old ladies are destroyed because of me. I'm not righteous. I'm wrongous. Stupidious.
Ah, don't let those gnomes and their illusions get you down. They're just gnomes and illusions.
Illusions?
Yeah, man. Think, what would regular old sweet ladies be doing wandering the hills of Mount Kragdor?
Maybe they're lost?
No way. This place is designed to mess you up, to mess with your head. None of this is real. It's all just trials to test your heroic attributes.
I think you can hear a little bit in that clip the playfulness with language, which is something that's really fun about this show. You never quite know how someone is going to phrase something. And so there's little inventions like, I'm not righteous, I'm wrongous. And those things just sort of pop up everywhere. And every throwaway line is sort of clever in that way.
Yeah, there's a moment in one episode where some characters tell Finn that they heard his plaintive wail and they dig his directionless fury. And I heard that line and just immediately my ears perked up like, what am I watching? I mean, that sort of language doesn't usually make it into a cartoon like this, which in addition to Miyazaki and Dungeons and Dragons has a very video game feel and also shades of Ren and Stimpy. There are a lot of fart jokes. There are a lot of butt jokes. But one of the things I liked about it is that even though you can sense the sort of melange of cultural influences, it's not full of references. It's not full of kind of pop culture sort of Shrek-like jokes. And apparently that's a deliberate choice on the part of the writers. And I do think it makes the show feel, you know, less dated, right? I mean, it doesn't feel like it's trying to be clever for you. It does feel like it's its own world, even though you can see all of these little things that have informed it.
All right. Well, the show, again, is Adventure Time. It airs on the Cartoon Network. It's in season 6 currently, and also it's available for streaming on Netflix. All right. On to our next topic. We're going to be talking about The Office, The Cube, the places where we spend all of our days of drudgery. And we are prompted to talk about this by a new book by Nikhil Saval called Cubed, The Secret History of the Workplace. The book came out a couple months ago. It's received reviews and commentary and prompted essays and think pieces about where we work and how it may be changing in the digital age. So we thought we'd talk about cubes as well. And it's actually a very appropriate moment for us to do so because the Slate offices in New York are about to change from cubes. We're ripping out all of our big square cubes and replacing them with smaller bench-style seating. I literally sent out an email last night telling everybody where they were going to sit in the new configuration. So it is a moment of cube flux at Slate. So I'll let David go first. How impressed are you by your cube, and how impressed do you anticipate being by your new cube?
I'm very curious what the new arrangement will be like. When I saw the design, what I immediately thought of was a coffee shop, which makes perfect sense because this is where so many people who do the kind of work that the three of us do, you know, that's where people spend their time. Is you go to a coffee shop, you plug in your laptop, and you start typing away, and maybe you're sitting across from somebody. And more people, I think, have gotten used to working in spaces like that. And at least in my mind, that is what this new space looks like. Our cubicles now are not classic cubicles in that they're more bullpen-style cubicles. You're not by yourself. You're not hemmed in. I sit with basically everyone else who writes regularly for Browbeat, which is the blog that I run for Slate. And I like that I can turn to Forrest Wickman or I can turn to Aisha Harris and say, hey, what are you working on? Oh, I just looked at that draft. Here's what I thought. And so that not all of our communication is via email. At the same time, reading these essays brought up, you know, deeper feelings that you cannot work in an office, as that term is understood broadly, and not want an office, right? They're just, if you're in a cubicle, you wish you had a corner office with windows and bookshelves. You're brought up to think that's status. That's, you know, a pat on the back. You deserve an office. And so even though that would interrupt the way that I work every day and one of the things I like about work, I'll never get rid of that desire, I don't think.
All right, noted. David wants an office. Dana, you obviously work at home under an array of postcards. and occasionally, do you mostly work at home or do you work sometimes from...
When I'm writing, I'm usually at home, yeah. But I will make the odd escape to a coffee shop or some library or something like that.
Right. So you are a critic. You work, you know, some of your work is going to see movies and then your work is writing about it. Do you ever wish that you came into an office every day and sat next to a David Hagland or an Aisha Harris and kibitzed with them all the time? Or are you happy kibitzing electronically?
Well, I had to say the Slate office culture seems pretty fun when I come through to tape the GabFest for some random errand at Slate. But I don't think I would be able to write in an office. I've never tried to write in an office. I have had a few jobs with cubicles, but they were temp jobs that I knew were going to end, in which I was doing something alienated and appropriately cubicle-like. But I think when I'm writing, what's happening is too ugly for other people to see. I feel like it needs to happen in the space of some sort of hidden lair.
Right. Well, I think one thing that's perhaps confusing for a Slate reading of this piece, right, is that fundamentally we're doing creative work, we're writing, collaborating. It's easy for me to say this as a boss with an office, but it's not quite Dilbert. It's not quite widgets, I think. I think most of the people who work here do not quite feel like they're putting meaninglessness into the world. And so that slightly complicates the knock on the cube. But I think one thing that the various pieces this book has prompted all focus on very interestingly is the history of the cubicle.
Yeah, I really love the way that it seems like Saval goes back in time and does a lot of research about the way office work and office design was conceived in the 19th century when essentially industrial production began to create the need for offices in the first place. So he talks about, you know, Dickensian counting houses and things that Melville writes about the office and Walt Whitman writes about the office and the sort of also the scorning of the office worker in the 19th century, the idea that the office worker, unlike a rough tradesman, was this kind of fey, you know, underdeveloped, non-manly man. You know, it's a whole history of the way of thinking about the office that's embedded in our current experience of it. It without us necessarily knowing it.
Right, and then the cubicle comes along initially as this idealistic way of liberating the office worker. So this guy, Robert Probst? He designed something called the Action Office, and he thought that this would, you know, make work more pleasant. But he designed it once, and then I guess that didn't take off, and then he designed a second version called Action Office 2, and that eventually became the cubicle, which really was just a way of getting more people into smaller spaces.
Right. If you look at the designs for the original Action Office, if you Google image search that, they're really great. They're these great chunky primary colors and these kind of Herman Miller furniture and odd angles. Nothing is squared off. Things are sort of a little bit open, like the bullpen place that you work that you described. But as soon as the Action Office 2 kicks in and there are cubicles put up, it seems like it just became an excuse to divide office space as efficiently as possible and cram people into boxes.
Right. And I think then the latest trend that we're seeing, which Seth Stevenson recently wrote about for Slate, is something called the open office, right? Which is basically people working at open tables without walls between them particularly, and which also often takes the step of pulling management out of the offices too and having everybody work at the same kind of cube style situation. But I think the one tension here that some of these reviews get at and that Seth spoke about in his piece is that there's always kind of the utopian social engineering way of talking about office design. We want people to sit in this way to create this sort of work environment, to create this sort of work experience, to create this sort of work product. And then there's the fundamental practical, we pay this much per square foot for a lease that runs for this term, and we've got to fit X amount of people into it. I think that a lot of times the way that people talk about office design imposes social and psychological rationales on top of what fundamentally end up being like happiness maximizing basic management decisions, you know?
Right. And for all the criticism of the cubicle, you see that there's both efficiency and practicality and also some attention to happiness management in the creation of the cubicle in the sense that it does give you walls. I mean, I think when I say that what happens at home is too ugly to be transported into an office, it also has to do with privacy and, you know, maybe a sense that you just sometimes have to wall everything out. I guess headphones are maybe a way that the modern office worker does that. But, you know, it seems great to have a chat with your coworker as they come by your desk, and maybe that adds to the mobility of the workplace and makes you come up with new projects. But there's also moments where you just need to shut everybody out and get your stuff done.
The other thing that came up in reviews of this book is the extent to which one can overstate the importance of the space in a worker's experience. I guess that near the end of the book, Saval makes the case for this shift toward office-less work, that now with our laptops and with the internet, we can work from wherever. And that sounds ideal in some ways, but really what it reflects is the greater instability and uncertainty of the American workplace, and that we, you know, many people don't have jobs, don't have benefits. You know, maybe they're, you know, an independent contractor whose, you know, next paycheck could come from anywhere or maybe from nowhere. And that can feel just as stressful and difficult as being in a little cubicle somewhere where at least you do have that security potentially.
Right. I mean, I think it sounds like he presents the end of the office as a liberation for the worker, and the notion of us all popping around on laptops, sometimes working on cool beanbag chairs in Silicon Valley and sometimes working from hip coffee shops in Brooklyn, and as a future that will liberate us. But I think actually that shift in work towards its omnipresence is the thing that is the most negative and frightening about work culture currently. I mean, I say this as someone who loves my job, and, you know, I go home and put the kids to bed, and then I go back online and send more emails, and mostly stuff I'm really interested in thinking about and doing, but it is all the time and everywhere. And the notion that when I'm in my cube or my office with whatever little accoutrements I've set up to make a little work life there, and then when I'm home, I'm home. I mean, that doesn't exist anymore for knowledge workers like us, and I think for a lot of people these days, that is the part that seems most difficult for people trying to create balanced lives going forward.
Yeah, but I have really mixed feelings about that. It is maybe the most interesting question that the book raises, this idea that perhaps the divide between work and life is something that arose, you know, a couple hundred years ago and is now dissolving, right? If you go farther back, there was a time when people didn't divide, oh, this is now my work day and this is now I'm at home. And that seems to maybe be happening again. And that's frightening on some level because we do want to be able to put it away and not think about it. And yet at the same time, I wonder if maybe, you know, blurring that distinction, there could be some hope there as well, because you are what you do, and maybe that's not a bad thing.
Well, the book again is Cubed by Nikhil Saval. Read it on your way to the office. All right, guys, it's time to endorse. Dana, what have you got for us today?
My endorsement today is inspired by the Adventure Time topic this week. I want to endorse a much less hip and more square cartoon, but one that I've been coming to enjoy lately through my daughter's enjoyment of it. It's called Phineas and Ferb. Did you guys ever watch Phineas and Ferb? It's, I believe, a Disney Channel cartoon, but it's also available on Netflix right now. It's been going on for some time, 6 years or so, and has gathered various Emmys along the way. It's just about two animated brothers and their adventures over the course of one summer, a summer that has now lasted for 6 or 7 years. And it's just basically about the things that Phineas and Ferb get up to, which sometimes have a vaguely Adventure Time-like sort of degree of impossibility. You know, they can invent time machines and travel to other planets, and they do all kinds of insane things during the course of the day in the summer. And their teenage sister Candace is always trying to bust them at these forbidden activities and failing. The main thing that makes Phineas and Ferb worth watching is the music. The way I started to fall for it is that my daughter would have it on, and I'd think, what's that annoying cartoon in the background? And then I'd start realizing, wow, these parody songs are great. They're almost to the level of the South Park or Simpsons parody songs, where there'll be, you know, Bollywood numbers and kind of, you know, full-on Broadway musicals and then torch ballads. And whoever does the music for that show, which I believe is just the two creators of the show, kind of whip out a song every week. The music alone makes it worthwhile. So Phineas and Ferb on Netflix or the Disney Channel.
David, what are you endorsing this week?
I'm going to endorse a voice. Has either of you ever listened to Ted Hawkins?
Mm-mm.
I only just recently discovered him, which is partly why I'm endorsing his voice, because I don't know his work all that well. I don't know his songs. But partly it's because his voice is the thing. I mean, as soon as you hear it, you want to hear it some more. It's both gravelly and bright at the same time, which seems like an impossible combination. Hawkins died in 1995 after this sort of star-crossed recording career. He is from Mississippi, I think, and was poor, and at one point became an addict and would, you know, I think he recorded his first recordings are go back to the early 70s, I think. But he would basically have little glimmerings of success and then disappear for a while and then be rediscovered. And the song in particular that I would recommend is one of his own. It's called The Good and the Bad. So if you want a specific song, look that one up. And I'm sure after you hear it, you'll want to hear several more.
That sounds great. I'm definitely going to check that out. All right. My endorsement this week is also from the pile of kid things that are interesting to adults. I want to endorse the work of the children's book author Mo Willems. He has written a series of books featuring two characters, Elephant and Piggy. Elephant is he's a bit of a melodramatic sort. He tends to find drama and woe in turmoil and everyday occurrences. And Piggy is his slightly smarter, saner friend who helps him through these travails and calms him down. The book that I've been loving recently is one called We Are in a Book, which is one of those classic books like There's a Monster at the End of This Book. It's a book about bookitude, about being in a book, about the experience of reading, which is really fun for our kids to encounter as they start to figure out why they like books so much and what it means to it plays with their sense of what it is they're doing when we're reading it to them. But I am not Mo Willems' only fan. There's a great story that ran, I think it was originally in the Times Book Review, but J.J. Abrams, the TV and movie creator, is also a huge, huge fan of Mo Willems, and he related this story amusingly. He wrote, "One of my favorite children's authors was introduced to us by our youngest son. When he was in kindergarten, he brought home some books by Mo Willems, who has one of the most remarkable comedic voices I've ever read. I was so blown away, I got his number from his agent and called him. I was essentially a sycophant, expressing what a deep fan of his I was, how I would love to work together one day. He was quiet on the phone, almost monosyllabic, disinterested. Frankly, it was a bit of an odd reaction. It wasn't until the next day that I discovered I had in error called Mo Willems of the Portland Trail Blazers." So he somehow accidentally had this conversation with an NBA player about the work of this children's book author. I recommend We Are in a Book by Mo Willems. And that's our show. Thanks so much, Dana.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, David, for pinch hitting.
Thanks.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wmyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or in the WMYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Happerman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Julia Turner, and we'll talk to you next week.
Living is good when you have someone to live with.